Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Speaking of Reliability. My name is Chris Jackson, and there is no one else here with me today. We're trying something a little bit different. We usually do these podcasts where it's at least two people, usually two people, and we're back and forth about a particular topic. But we're trying to explore a different approach where just one of us, in this case me, bangs on about a particular red-hot incident or issue. And the one I'm going to be talking about today is that time the internet slowed down recently. I know that's not very profound or very illuminating, but it's actually a really interesting topic because we know that internet issues usually cloud our day. We have to deal with multiple instances of internet cutting out at the wrong time. But that is often very individualistic or localized. Sometimes it's just your router needing to be reset. We've all done that. But in this case, I'm talking about an incident that happened in June of this year. And what happened was a bunch of services or platforms, including Twitter, Reddit, Zoom, Discord, Microsoft Teams, you name it, they all essentially stopped working because the internet had gone down. And so we had this outage across multiple platforms, multiple internet service providers, and so on. And when this happens, when you see what appears to be an outage or incident affecting multiple platforms, multiple services, we usually assume there's some sort of cyber attack, or maybe an overarching cloud provider has failed or something else. Usually it's very software centric, but in this case, it was hardware 101. And to understand what happened, we need to look at what or how internet is provided across North America. Many people have never heard of a company called Zayo, Z or Z-A-Y-O. And that's because Zayo doesn't provide internet, at least not directly. It's a company that owns an extraordinarily large network of fiber optic cables. And so, as everyone can imagine, fiber optic cables are an essential part of communicating data from point A to point B. In other words, very important part of your internet. And so if you look at your computer, which has a web browser open or is otherwise accessing the internet, the chain of communication goes something like this. Your computer then attaches to your, or sorry, communicates with your internet service provider, which then communicates with a regional internet service provider. That's right. There is usually a couple of layers there. Then we have the internet backbone, i.e. the infrastructure that allows that data to be communicated. And that's where Zayo becomes an important part of this story, which then allows your internet service provider to connect with or communicate with a cloud provider, which then goes on to speak to a website, which has all that wonderful information that all those different applications and newspapers and everything else need to make your internet appear to work. And so while we're usually aware that there are different layers within our internet as it appears on our computer, it's sometimes useful to remind ourselves there are certain layers there. And things like Zayo, which is not a commonly well or not a well-known company in the world of internet services, it's absolutely essential. As you can imagine, if you can't communicate, then we have a problem. And so what actually happened? We don't know too much. All we know is that after there was a widespread panic and pandemonium, as it usually is when multiple services disappear at the same time, internet service providers, Zayo, everyone starts looking into going to fault finding and do all these other wonderful things, well, necessary things, panic things, crazy firefighting things to try and work out what went wrong. And as I mentioned before, a very easy assumption to make for these sorts of scenarios is that we are dealing with something to do with a cyber attack or something or something like that. And I've talked about this in some of my conversations regarding software before. It goes the other way in many cases. For example, there was an instance where Nissan vehicles in particular, the passenger side airbag was not operating properly. And Nissan went through all manners of root cause analysis, all manners of investigation, tearing seats apart, looking at the sensors on the seats that sort of allow the car to turn on the passenger side airbag. Just for those of you who don't know, the passenger side airbag of a vehicle can only be turned on in certain circumstances. You don't want the airbag to be turned on when you have groceries or a dog or a small child on your front passenger seat. That, in the event of a crash, the airbag deploying can actually cause more harm than it prevents. And so we have in all vehicles, you have these sensors in the passenger seat to detect when an adult human, nothing but an adult human is sitting there, which then goes on to turn on the passenger airbag. And for whatever reason, the Nissan vehicles, that wasn't happening. There are adults sitting in the front passenger seat and the airbag was not being turned on in a certain circumstances, not deploying when it needed to. Of course, that's a safety problem. And Nissan did everything you could think of to try and uncover what they believed to be a hardware root cause of failure. They looked at the sensors. They looked at the tools making the sensors. They tried to recreate it with their vehicles as they were produced, and they couldn't find it. Eventually, they had the audacity to claim that customers were sitting in the passenger seat incorrectly, as if we need to be lectured on how to sit down, and sitting down incorrectly is a thing. It's not. I eventually found that it was a software problem. And get this, the software problem was so complex and so complicated that it meant that the algorithm in certain circumstances where the vehicle was turned on, when the engine was vibrating, creating this vibration throughout the vehicle, including the front passenger seat, if certain adults sat in the front passenger seat after the car was turned on and idling in a particular way, those passengers would not be sensed would not be detected, and the airbag would be turned off. And that was very, very specific way of this software failure manifesting itself, and it just goes to show how truly insidious software failures can be. So hard to diagnose and find in many cases. So going back to this internet outage, we often think of it the other way for internet. When we think of widespread internet outages, you usually think something software-centric, cyber attacks, or some sort of software update which didn't go well and shuts the whole system down. And that's what the initial focus was. But it was all down to that fiber optic network that company Zayo, in this case, owned and operated. Something happened to that fiber optic cable. It got damaged. And there's lots of ways fiber optic cable can be damaged. For example, it can be damaged when someone is digging into the ground to build a house. We usually think of those scenarios more for gas lines in particular. There's some hilarious videos, or shockingly hilarious videos, on YouTube that show what happens when people dig before checking if there's a gas line in their property. So when you damage a fiber optic cable, you don't get a huge reaction. There's nothing exploding. You might even do it inadvertently without even knowing you did it. Another way fiber optic cable can be damaged is through landslides and earthquakes and things like that. But they're usually a bit easier to identify. Usually, these companies usually know or monitor seismic activity across their network, so they're fairly comfortable. They're fairly good at linking natural events with bad outcomes for their fiber optic cables. That is, they have, I'm not sure what they're called, seismic sensors, geosensors, where they can detect if an earthquake is happening or a landslide is occurring, and therefore if that happens, that's usually a trigger to inspect. But that wasn't the case, we don't think. They haven't divulged too much about what went wrong, which potentially means that it might have been down to their own maintenance or their own installation. Who knows? But But the fiber optic cable itself, what is fiber optic cable? It's a long, thin glass fiber. And the reason why it's amazing is because this glass fiber allows photons of light to be essentially trapped within the fiber and then pass up and down, obviously moving at somewhere approaching the speed of light. The speed of light is different through different materials. The speed of light is fastest in the vacuum. The light slows down a little bit in solid. So notwithstanding, data is moving very, very quickly. And because it's light, you can control magnitude and frequency and all sorts of things to really dial in the information you're sending and receiving. But of course, these fiber optic cables are very thin, hair-like, and probably, thicker than a human hair, but very, very thin. Think fishing line. But the fiber optic networks that we're talking about here, which control all the data or allow all the data to be communicated, they are usually in big rope-like bundles where thousands of tiny fiber optic cables are bundled together, each passing light up and down. And around the outside of those fibers, you usually have some sort of membrane or cover or protection to keep out water and obviously protect against abrasion and things like that. So for such a widespread outage, you're usually thinking that an entire, let's call it a fiber rope, was cut or damaged in some way. And so we still don't know why, but there's lots of explanations. And my guess would be accidental human intervention. And that being not the first thing you think of, means it takes a long time to diagnose. And it also is a very important lesson to understand when it comes to things like redundancy. We often think, okay, we have redundancy, it's a network, it's not just a single track, or it's not quite as simple as that. While you do want to have multiple fiber optic cables and fibers go through different mountain ranges and different gullies and different paths, it's not always possible. Mother Nature controls the texture of Earth's surface and not us. And sometimes, just through geography, you don't have a lot of options about where you can run cables. So the ability to have redundancy is not as easy as it might sound. Now, there's plenty of examples where internet service providers skimp on redundancy just to save costs, and it has bad outcomes. So we don't really know exactly what happened here because the location of the incident hasn't been disclosed either. But many organizations, for example, deliberately purchase multiple or get their internet from multiple service providers. And this is a good wake-up call for those sorts of organizations who think they have redundancy. They often don't, because even if you purchase your internet through multiple internet service providers, they often are using the same fiber optic network in order to get their data, get their information. And so it's not uncommon for when you have fiber optic cable damage for multiple internet service providers to go offline at the same time. Now, in this case, the list of services that were affected, I think I touched on some of them, they included Twitter, Reddit, Zoom, Discord, Microsoft Teams, Canva, Fortnite, geez, that's, when Fortnite goes down, there's trouble everywhere, Robinhood, Cloudflare, and lots of cloud-hosted applications. And so for many users, it looked like half the internet simply disappeared, and reports on outage monitoring sites just surged within minutes. And so if you listen to that list, there's a wide range of different services, different platforms, different companies all going offline at the same time. You better believe they didn't just simply have the same internet service provider. So even if you purchase internet from multiple service providers, it's not a guarantee that a fault which affects one will not affect another. So what can we learn from this incident? Well, it'd be great if we knew a lot more about the particular incident in question, but we don't. But it means that we need to really interrogate this concept of redundancy. And we also need to embrace the fact that there's some baseline level of fragility that we cannot go beyond. So in this case, we could have be as simple as one backhoe breaking the half the internet. And the very easy thing to do is say, well, we need to have more cables, we need to have more protection. We don't know, but it's going to be an issue moving forward. And we don't know too much about the incident, but this happens over and over again, where a little thing triggers all sorts of other issues. I'll give you another example of a hardware-centric example of where redundancy isn't all that it cracked up to be. A DC-10 aircraft had an issue where one of its three engines failed catastrophically. The DC-10 is a somewhat unique aircraft in that its three engines, two of which are located on each wing, and the third located within the tail itself, all designed in a way where one engine can allow the plane to fly somewhat satisfactorily. So even if you lose one engine, the other two should be able to do the job. And in this case, the other two engines were fine. But the problem with this one engine that failed was that it was the tail engine. Why is that important? Well, a lot of really important componentry is forced to go through the tail of the aircraft. So what happened with this engine when it failed is essentially all the turbine blades exploded somewhat catastrophically. Exploded is the wrong term because there was not a pressure release. It's just that they fractured and all of a sudden you have debris flying out of the engine itself. And it just so happened that the aircraft in particular, in this instance, it had three hydraulic systems. Always a good idea to have three hydraulic systems for redundancy. You only need one of those hydraulic systems to work for the pilots to be able to control the flaps, ailerons, and rudder and everything else. But as you can imagine, the tail of the aircraft where you have the rudder and you have the ailerons at the back, the hydraulic lines need to pass through a relatively small space because the tail of the plane sort of collapses towards a point. And that's just where that third engine is, the one that exploded. The one that ejected debris. And it just so happened that the turbine blades that left the engine cowling at a great rate of knots took out all three hydraulic lines because they're all very almost co-located. The hydraulic lines in the rest of the aircraft are deliberately routed or routed in through geographically or physically dispersed locations. That is, you don't want your hydraulic lines to go through the same bulkhead or through the same hole. It makes it much more likely for a single piece of debris to be able to take out three hydraulic lines all at once. But again, the design of the aircraft, there's only so much you can do. And when those three hydraulic lines come together at the back of the aircraft, well, a single incident can relatively easily take out all three hydraulic lines. And so the pilots lost a lot of control. And it is a bad news story in that a lot of people died as a result of this incident. But there's a bit of good news as well, because the pilots were able through amazing airmanship to get the plane on the ground. And how they did that without any control was to essentially use the two remaining engines to steer and guide the plane into an airport. In fact, in this particular scenario, there was an off-duty pilot who was traveling as a passenger who came up and helped the two pilots, the pilot and the co-pilot, land this plane. And he was essentially doing nothing but controlling the throttle of the two remaining engines. And there is footage of this plane landing. And when I say landing, that's a very, very, it's a strong term for what happened. The plane did touch down, and because it was coming in so fast and it was so hard to control, it did disintegrate upon impact. But because they got it on the ground in a somewhat controlled manner, a relatively large number of people survived the incident. It's just an astounding piece of airmanship to get a plane without any control on the ground don't aim it at a runway and make it happen. But it just goes to show that even though you have three redundant hydraulic systems, you have three engines, redundancy can be very, very, very fragile. And so what other dependencies can occur in, well, internet software spaces in particular? Well, software defects are a big one. If you have a particular incident, I think Y2K is probably the most well-known perceived defect, or sorry, refers to the most well-known perceived defect, where clocks would be resetting after a after 1999. It wasn't as big a deal as it turned out to be, perhaps because we were well aware of it in advance and took the right steps, and precious few services were offline as a result. But software defects can cause all sorts of issues. Server failures, another big one. Database corruption. Perhaps the biggest one is software updates that go wrong. Anytime you have a software update, what you're doing is you're changing code. Code that was previously working, albeit with a vulnerability or a defect, you do something to update that code, which then almost certainly, has the non-zero chance of you introducing a defect for which you have not previously tested or anticipated. That's another favorite way of telecommunications companies, for example, to make your mobile phone or cell phone stop working straight away. And even though you have nominal redundancy in your network and your system, it's amazing how software can propagate through a system in ways human beings cannot easily envisage. We're pretty good at envisaging hardware failure scenarios, but software is a real challenge. Other examples of common cause failures is what we call them. Sorry, I should have told that this is what we call a common cause failure, where you have a single incident taking out what appears to be multiple redundant fail-safe backup mechanisms. Fukushima is another one. Fukushima was, I'm not going to go through a blow-by-blow of what went wrong, but long story short, the operator, TEPCO, cut a lot of corners. And while they did have some emergency backup generators outside of the tsunami zone, or did not get inundated during the tsunami itself, those backup generators then fed through a control room, which was in the tsunami zone. And of course, it doesn't matter if all those backup generators are working fine if they can't then control the emergency cooling systems, which are needed when you have an emergency such shutdown. Things go bad. Before I move away from Fukushima, everyone looks at that as a very bad incident, which it clearly was. A couple of interesting little factoids. One, no one died directly from the Fukushima incident itself, but I think about 200 people died from the evacuation. So it's an interesting little factoid. And another, perhaps even more interesting factoid, is that there was another nuclear power plant much closer to the tsunami which took out Fukushima, which was exposed to much bigger waves. It was fine, and that's because the operator for that nuclear power plant, and the name of that power plant escapes me, and it was on I think it was on an offshore island. I can't be sure about that, but they took it seriously, and we know how to design tsunami-proof nuclear power plants if you want to do it properly. So that nuclear power plant was fine, even though it was subjected to larger waves than the waves experienced at Fukushima. Not only did it survive, it was the only thing that survived in the local township. And so it became the evacuation point for the survivors, as opposed to what happened at Fukushima. The other reverse happened. So that's another example. What else? Another good example is where you have backup engines sharing the same fuel tank. So you think fuel is a relatively benign problem, a simple component or simple subsystem, and fuel tanks rarely fail. That's true. But what happens if you have contaminated fuel? Takes out both engines or redundant engines at the same time. I do have an example of how an organization deals with this concept of redundancy, and that is Netflix. Netflix has an approach to software development which involves the simian armies. A simian refers to apes and monkeys. And so what Netflix do is they create these programs they label, they name after monkeys and apes, such as Chaos Monkey. Now, Chaos Monkey is a program which randomly disables a server. Why would you do that? Well, your coders, your software engineers, your developers are told, hey, you need to develop a code and a system that will, that's able to tolerate this Chaos Monkey program randomly selecting a server and turning it off. And so the code is then created in a way where it can easily deal with a server that was working once, now just magically not working. And then there was Chaos, they created another program in the Symbian Army called Chaos Gorilla, which it took out, I think, an entire data center. And so these poor old developers said, okay, we need to develop code where an entire data center goes offline, the customers don't notice. Chaos Kong, entire geographic area taken offline. Code still needs to make, so the code needs to be written to ensure people still watch their movies. Another program, I think, was Latency Monkey, where this program would deliberately introduce latency or delay into the communications, the ones and zeros moving up and down the fiber optic cables. Again, the software engineers had to design something that could allow latency issues to not be a problem, etc., etc., etc. So Netflix is a good example of how you can create a philosophy where redundancy is baked into the DNA of your solutions. And of course, it takes more resources to code a solution than having to deal with Chaos Monkey, Chaos Gorilla, Chaos Kong, Latency Monkey, so on and so forth. But as a rule, Netflix is never the problem. It's usually the internet service provider that makes your movies laggy or you can't or not allow you to log on easily, for example. So that's where I'll probably finish things up for today in this conversation. And hopefully it was a little bit illuminating. Hopefully it was just reminded us that in very digital services and software-centric services, hardware can still ruin your day, especially when we believe that we are baking redundancy into our systems. But also some of these follow-on conversations about how redundancy is a lot more fragile than you might think. We might think we've designed redundancy into something, but common cause failures often cause catastrophes. And hopefully that little discussion about Netflix is an inspiring anecdote about how we can do things better. But I'll leave things there for today. So that was the first attempt at doing a single person speaking of reliability, which I love because I don't have Fred or somebody else at the other side of the table telling me I'm wrong or challenging my take on something. Very annoying when people disagree with you, but it sort of allows us to talk about an incident or an issue in a very sort of current affairs way, which I think is, mate, well, I suspect there's potential for that to be very helpful. If that's the case, let us know. Please, if you have any feedback, any questions, please go to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And when you're there, you can ask questions, you can make comments, you can make suggestions, you can record your own voice where you talk about what you like, what you don't like, and what we can do better. So we love hearing feedback from you guys. We love answering questions in these podcasts. And hopefully this conversation fit the bill in lieu of having two or more of us going back and forth in a podcast. So beyond that, I hope you have a splendid day and look forward to talking with you guys soon.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.